Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Again, thanks to Carol. Thanks to all of you for being here at this Great Decisions Conference. I greatly appreciate it. I was briefly mentioning that certainly as everyone in this room, the nation, perhaps to some degree the world knows, President Trump travels to Asia today, and while he won't pick up the pivot policy of his presidential predecessor, it is an era when leaders look to the Pacific for as their top geopolitical priority. And yet one can argue that the alacrity of Atlantic issues is more important than ever, particularly because the president has questioned the efficacy of post-war international institutions like NATO and the European Union. And of course, as our panelists today might be quick to counter, beyond the Atlantic, other bodies of water are equally critical, both metaphorically and literal, in terms of the future of the Europe, which is the subject of today's conference and this panel. In just a few examples, the Mediterranean migration crisis continues to convulse countries, if not continents. A revanchist Russia that David spoke about just a minute ago and we'll explore again menaces Baltic countries, and Balkan nations on or near the Adriatic face uncertain political futures once again. These are just a few of the key questions on the future of Europe, and we'll hope to get to our panelists, whom I'll introduce in a moment. But I'm sure that many of you have questions beyond what was asked of David yesterday for the broader continent and the future of Europe. So while we're engaging in this initial dialogue, as happened before, comment cards will be sent along, and if this morning's panels were any indication, and previous Global Minnesota conferences are, you'll certainly have as compelling a questions as anyone, so I want to get to them as quickly as possible. But first, just a brief introduction of our panelists. All of you got packets as you came in, so there are bios of much more breadth and depth of their remarkable accomplishments, but you just heard the compelling presentation by David Rennie, the Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist. Joining him to my right is Dr. Birgit Glorious, who is an Associate Professor of Human Geography of East Central Europe at Chemnitz University of Technology. And to my left, your right here, Sonia Dridi, who covers the U.S. and international news for France 24, among other broadcast media. Let's have a nice round of applause for our panelists here today. And we're certainly going to get back to the issues of Brexit about the UK, but I'm going to start across the channel here and start with you, Sonia, and look at your home country. And, you know, the world watched as an outsider, if not a novice, upended the system and took the presidency, and yet, of course, the experience in France was distinctly different from what happened in 2016 with the election of President Donald Trump. And I want to know if you could give us all a sense of just how much the Emmanuel Macron phenomenon is a result of him being an unusually skilled politician, a rejection of the status quo, including sclerotic political parties, some of the broader dynamics, and in fact, perhaps a reflection, if not a rejection, of what they saw in other elections, including here in America. And what explains it all, and how is he doing so far?
So I think there is different factors who can explain how Emmanuel Macron, that was kind of an outsider, like Donald Trump, you know, got elected. First, he got lucky because his main opponent on the right, François Fillon, had a lot of corruption scandal, and he was the one that everyone bet he will be the next president, and he got out of the run because of that. Then, of course, after Donald Trump's election, a lot of Americans told me, so, you know, it's done. Like, Marine Le Pen is going to be the next president in France. I was a bit skeptical because of the landscape in France of the political parties and how the National Front has had like such a bad image all of the past dozen of years, even though Marine Le Pen managed to give it a much better image because she's like a younger woman that didn't have like as much racist statement that her father. Trump got elected as a Republican candidate. And if you vote for the National Front in France, you're considered as a racist. You're not voting for like a right party, you're voting for the far right. So I just thought that this is why we have two rounds in France. First round, you know, people say they're angry, they vote for the National Front, and second round, usually this is where like people have second thought, and you know, what happened was pretty much what I thought will happen. She did had like a historical high score for French for the National Front, and there was what I think is noticeable is there was such a high abstention rate, so almost 40% of people didn't go to vote, so that's huge, and that means that, you know, Macron kind of got lucky, and also because of the political landscape. But I think that for a big part of the country, still represented something that France really needed. It gave like a very dynamic image. It kind of like drained the swamp, if we want to take like the Trump's expression, because I mean, since, you know, I always saw, since I'm born, almost the same faces in France. Like we have the same politicians, and everyone was complaining, and young people were not that much involved into politics, I mean, generally. And Macron really, I mean, first he kind of killed the Socialist Party because a lot of people from the left ended up voting for Emmanuel Macron. So he really like changed the political landscape, and that's very striking. That's huge. It really like, you know, changed something in France in that way. And for instance, we said he brought some renouveau, like he renewed the political landscape. A lot of people issue from immigration or who lives in the suburb, the banlieue, like we say in France, got much more involved during these elections because on a local level, a lot of people joined En Marche, his party, so onwards, I think we say in English. Mm-hmm. And for instance, I know personally three young ladies in their 30s who are from the banlieue, the suburbs, who all, you know, their parents are issued from immigration, are from you know, Serbia, North Africa, and Senegal. And they are now members of the National Assembly. They're like MPs. And this is pretty extraordinary. I mean, we would never have thought of that like 2 years ago. So there is a lot of hope in that sense, in that sense that we feel it really wants, you know, we felt the past few years, even among, you know, friends and people that we know, a lot of people who were educated went to live abroad in London, in the US, because we felt that France was a bit sleepy. And I think now with Macron, a lot of even young people are more willing to go back to France, or you know, at least they have a better image of their country. But of course, when you try to be not left, not right, or like both in the same time, there is a much more bigger path for the extreme party, so extreme left or far left or far right. And so I think a lot of people, also observers in France, are worried that the far left and right parties are taking much more place in the society, because a lot of people also see Macron as the elite, you know, is this Parisian, there is also the thing that is a typical Parisian, and work in finance and hang out with people, you know, for like the big radio station or like the big, you know, CAC 40 company. And so a whole part of the population doesn't feel represented by him. And so it was pretty extraordinary, too, that the past few months, the big opposition leader was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, that is from the far left party, that was kind of forgotten these past few years. But because, you know, there is not that much more opposition on the market since the Socialist Party, you know, doesn't really exist anymore, Mélenchon was the big voice of the opposition. So a lot of people in France also were worried by that. He tried to organize a lot of protests against Macron's labor reforms. And he admitted in September that Macron kind of won because there was not that much mobilization. And for now, you know, the reforms are going forward. So he's a bit more quiet since a month or so. So that was also a victory for Macron, even though if we say like his popularity rate is decreasing, that's very common in France. It was the same for Hollande in 2012, a few months after he got elected. And, you know, French people like to say they're not happy and go in the street and protest a lot, but it doesn't mean that it is in a terrible position. So I think now the challenge will be, you know, to see how the fact, you know, that is at the center and is already being criticized by, you know, the right because they think that his reform, labor reform advantage, you know, is not good for people who have money. And then the left criticize him now because they think that with this labor reform, it's going to be much more easy for people in companies to be fired. So, you know, it's going to be a big challenge for him to make everyone happy. And the risk, and I think it might happen, is that the far right party, for instance, is going to keep being attractive for a lot of people.
Well, thank you for that excellent analysis, Sonia. And if we just look a little bit eastward, Professor, of course, Germany just went through a significant national election as well. And to some degree, it appears that, you know, some of the dynamics are distinctly different. Some are quite similar in terms of, you know, in France, you had the National Front. In Germany, you had the Alternative for Germany. And yet the election doesn't seem to be totally over because Chancellor right. Merkel, to some degree, the political antithesis of Monsieur Macron in terms of being the establishment figure, not just in Germany, but in the Western alliance, hung on, but she doesn't have a government yet. So why don't you take us through the German experience and a little bit of compare and contrast to what happened in France?
Yes, so first of all, this is the test if you can hear me. Yeah, okay, fine, thank you. Yes, the German elections are not over yet. We are still struggling for getting a new state administration. And as David showed on his maps and in his analysis, the party of Chancellor Merkel lost most of the votes in comparison to all parties. So she is the winner of the elections, but a very weak winner. And she's now trying to make a completely new coalition with the Green Party, which has more leftist ideas, and then with the Federal Party, which is more neoliberal. And then we have the Alternative for Germany, which entered the national parliament as a third strongest party. And we are really concerned about this situation. In the corner of the country where I live, the Alternative gained most of the votes. That turned out to be the strongest party in this region, which is a part of East Germany. And we already heard about those differences of all those elections we had in Europe. You analyzed it by age, by urban and rural regions, by unemployment situation. And I can add this all up to our election results, that these are really also people who are thinking that they are left behind, that they are not heard, that they are not valued by the national elites. And this is, again, still something that comes from the transformation period. If you look that most parts of the East German regions voted so strongly for the Alternative for Germany, that this is a discussion that now comes up again, that the transformation, even though they left the people quite well off in financial terms because we have a very good social system, many of them were lost their jobs, never entered in new jobs again, in qualitatively good jobs again, of a certain generation, which was maybe at the age of 40 at the transformation period in the beginning of the 1990s. And these are the people who are now forming this coalition, far right-wing coalition, protesting against the national elite. So this is quite comparable to the other elections we had. The only aspect which is maybe unique is that in Germany, the main argument for the voters of the right-wing party and also for the right-wing populists to collect those voters is the question of asylum and refugees. Mm-hmm. So this was the number one topic of the elections.
Well, thank you for that. And David, I know you certainly addressed some and many of these topics, particularly as it pertains, you know, to the UK. But as you are well aware, the re-election of Chancellor Merkel, the election of Emmanuel Macron has revitalized talk of a stronger Franco-German alliance. And I wanted to know if you could comment on that development in particular, where that might leave Prime Minister May, and where that, if indeed the center of political gravity continues to shift to France and Germany, where that might leave the so-called special relationship between the United States and United Kingdom.
So to start with the Franco-German alliance, I remember being very struck when I was, so I was 5 years in Brussels, and I left Brussels as the kind of the euro crisis was really exploding. I left in 2010. And the then president of the European Commission, who was a Portuguese guy, José Manuel Barroso, I remember him saying in private to us, but I think he then said it in public, that with France really in real trouble at that time, French banks were, you know, the real hidden fear. Everyone was talking about Greek banks and Italian banks, but the real fear was that French banks were actually in a lot of trouble as the euro crisis kind of exploded. And he had this phrase that the Franco-German alliance is working at the moment because the Germans need it to hide how strong they are, and the French need it to hide how weak they are. And that was a kind of change. So the first kind of few years, the first few decades of European construction, if you talked to British diplomats in Brussels, they were very frustrated often by the Franco-German alliance because it was essentially the French saw them. So the French were brilliant at using war guilt to basically make the Germans pay the bills and the French took the decisions. And I remember a British ambassador saying to me, you know, if you went into the room thinking you had a solid deal with the Germans against the French, you were not safe, because there was a certain look that the French could give the Germans during the meeting, which was like... And then the Germans were like, oh, and they'd side. And they would side with the French again. Whereas if you went into the room with the French against the Germans, that was rock solid. Because the French were like, yeah, you know, they were just, they didn't feel the same guilt. So that was... And you had literally, you had people like, I think it was Mitterrand had this phrase about the French, or maybe it was de Gaulle, that the French were the drivers of the ox cart and the Germans kind of pulled the ox cart. And that was, you know, they pay the bills and we tell them what to do. And that was always, you know, every country in Europe has a secret selfishness. Some don't keep it a secret as others, like my own. But, you know, it was always a mystery that the French were so very, very keen on, you know, European things, but actually the French are basically quite into their national sovereignty and not being told what to do. And it was basically that they had given themselves the role of driving the ox cart, and the poor Germans paid the bills and did what they were told. And so France, I remember Jean-Claude Trichet, when he was head of the European Central Bank, talking about one of the big arguments, which sounds very arcane, but as ever with Brussels, it's basically a power fight. So the French would always push for European economic government and a European finance minister. That sounds unbelievably boring, but what it basically is a row about whether the euro is more like the Deutschmark or the French franc. So in the days of the Deutschmark, because of the German historical experience of, you know, Germans basically, monetary stability is seen as not having Hitler again. I mean, you go to the Bundesbank Museum in Frankfurt, they have the Geldmuseum, they take high school students on tours through, and you get shown the history of hyperinflation in the 1920s and 30s, and monetary instability, and then you get Hitler. And the message is really clear. You know, if you don't have a strong central bank keeping, you know, monetary control, you're going to have Hitler again. It's a bulwark of democracy. The French franc was basically the French president would ring up the bank of the, you know, the governor of the Bank of France and say, I've got an election coming up. Can you play with interest rates to give an artificial boost to the economy, maybe devalue the franc, because we're going to go into the election with a kind of sugar rush of growth from a devaluation or from a lowering of interest rates. The French always wanted it to be a bit more like the French franc. But the deal was, if the Germans were going to give up the Deutschmark, the promise was that the euro would basically be the kind of Deutschmark in disguise, and it was going to be based in Frankfurt. I remember Trichet talking about this point of economic kind of selfishness, that Trichet came to talk. We had a dining club of journalists in Brussels. We'd get all these people in for these off-the-record dinners, and very tasty dinners. And Trichet said that when he was in the Paris job, when he was governor of the Bank of France, he would go to the French National Assembly and he would say, so, you know, gentlemen, do you want economic government of Europe, European economic government? They'd go, yes! And they'd say, so do you want the Europeans to be able to tell us what we do with our monetary policy? No! And so... Basically, it was a kind of con. It was European meant France kind of controlling things behind the scenes. Now we're clearly in a new world, that Germany is a different Germany, France is a different France. Politically, Macron has this kind of wind behind him. Is that going to lead to the two countries between them kind of sorting out all the essential kind of construction kind of flaws like the euro, I'm still really skeptical. Because, you know, in Brussels, people tell you a story about the euro, for example, is not working because Brussels didn't give itself the correct instruments so that the center could control, you know, have budget oversight over national budgets and stuff. You know, there's all these kind of process arguments. So you don't have euro-denominated bonds being issued in the right way. And I'm a political guy. I think that the reason that the euro is still in trouble is that to make it work, you have to have transfers between the north and the south that people just don't want to do. Germans don't want to work till 67 so that Greeks can retire at 55. And if that's the problem with the euro and all of these European structures, which may be fixed, is not kind of it's not process. It's because it's still a country of nation states, but they now share a currency within the eurozone. If you're a German voter and you don't want to pay for Greeks to retire at 55, you don't have any say over when Greeks retire. So, you know, they get to do what they want and then take the money. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. I don't think Europeans to date like each other enough to kind of deepen in that way at the kind of crudest level. And so, you know, I wish it well, and Britain is clearly walking away. And one of the things that is a real shock for the countries that used to be Britain's allies is they do not want to be left alone at the negotiating table with the French and the Germans, because then they are, you know, basically the French and the Germans will tell everyone what to do all the time. Angela Merkel did not want to be left alone at the table with the French. She needed the Brits as a counterparty. Germany, and I bow to you, but Germany historically has liked to have the veto on big European decisions. Doesn't always want to be the one that crafts the policy or that takes the decision or is even seen taking the decision, but it loves to have the deciding vote. And that whole structure has been completely destabilized by the departure of the Brits.
Well, the international institution that's supposed to bind all this together, of course, the European Union, was heartily embraced by Emmanuel Macron when he took the stage after his resounding victory. He did it to Ode to Joy, the unofficial EU anthem, you know, that they played there. And of course, Angela Merkel is a staunch defender. So before I get to some terrific questions, which I already have, and please keep these coming, and we'll get to these in just a moment, share with us first in France and second in Germany, please, where the EU stands with the voters. The French and German electorates, respectively, voted in people who were staunch defenders of the EU. Was that grudgingly, or are the voters coming around to reappreciate this institution?
I mean, I think that the population that is more highly educated, we went to Grandes Écoles in France, or we'll travel around, or we did the Erasmus program that is very famous in France, where you can have exchange with universities in Europe. Of course, they really appreciate that with Emmanuel Macron, and he really, really insisted on his will, you know, to have a strong union, European Union, and so that was really a big part of his presidential campaign. But once again, for a lot of people who still, you know, struggle day to day in France, or the working class, who also has issue with security problems, because you know, a lot of people now are angry with the Schengen space because it allows people to travel as they will, and so we will come to that maybe talking about the immigration issues, but they feel that everyone, you know, can arrive, and among them, you know, alleged terrorists, and comes to France very easily. So a lot of people also see European Union as a threat. So I think that part of the electorate that voted for Marine Le Pen or didn't go to vote doesn't really recognize this appeal for the European Union. So once again, I think, you know, maybe a slight majority of voters, people who actually went to vote, will be favorable to that, you know, a stronger European Union. But it's still, I think, largely in European countries, I mean, it's still hard to get the people, the people, excited about European Union, especially because the institutions are very complicated. If you talk to them about a cultural exchange or university exchange, it rings a bell, but of course not everyone has the chance to do that. And now with the security issues in Europe, I think some people see it as a threat.
We're going to get to the security issues in just a moment, including one of the questions here, but how about in Germany and the reflection?
I think it's quite comparable. I mean, the European Union is something which is perceived as being quite practical, especially for those younger, well-educated people who are mobile and who take this opportunity of the open Schengen borders. But apart from being practical, there's nothing you can really like bind your heart with. It's like if you try to develop emotions, and we were talking about identity issues and about populism and nationalism, this is something where people cannot really develop an identity to the European Union. And we had those huge expansion periods in 2004 when we took on 10 new countries into the European Union, and then 2007 Bulgaria and Romania, which are still the poorest countries of the whole European Union. And even without the recent immigrations, even before that, we had in Germany a lot of discussions about poor Europeans from Eastern Europe coming to Germany and destabilizing the social security system. And also there the question came up why all those people are eligible to travel throughout Europe and just take residence and take advantage of the social system. So it's a complicated question, and it's something that is difficult to be addressed by politicians to really touch the emotions of the people.
Well, thank you. And I mentioned we're going to get to the security issue, one of the threats of a transnational basis, you know, that not just Europe, of course, but the United States, the Western world, and a lot of places on the globe are contending with here. A question in the card directly stated to you is what your analysis of Western media coverage of terrorist attacks, specifically if these coverage voice the majority Muslim pertaining to the religion of Islam, and what you perceive perhaps as a journalist seeing coverage and of course the tragic events that have taken place in your country over the last 2 years or so, and then even just recently the tragedy in New York.
So how the media
covering this, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So first, I think there is something also important to notice in France and Europe, and that now that I'm in the US, I think it's comparable. There is a huge skepticism now for media, even in France, that it's kind of new, I guess, like the past few years in the US. That strikes me because now, you know, being a journalist, even in France, you have so many criticism more than before. On the way how the media cover the terrorist attack, I mean, I think it's, I think in France particularly, because people and journalists are used to the immigration coming from North Africa, especially since many years, people are trying to be really careful to not mix things, you know? So to try to not, you know, as soon as there is a terrorist attack, not necessarily right away, you know, that it's Arabs or like people are trying to be very, very careful and having all the information before, you know, giving statements. And I think it's really difficult for now for Muslim in France because you know they've been living in the Muslim population is I think now around 6 million in France, but I think you know it's more around like 8 million even though the statistics say 6. And I think it's part of the backlash and how like there is more votes for Marine Le Pen. So the media are trying to be careful and there is a lot of explanation, you know, on like Salafism now, for instance, because a lot of the terrorists are we say that they are Salafis, but they there is a lot of Salafists in France who are like peaceful, so you know, French media really try to explain that the terrorists are mainly like radical Salafists, and that it's not the same thing than you know more peaceful Salafists. Even though it's also a problem within French society, but I think there is a maybe more that I see that in the U.S. The media in the U.S. there is really an effort to try to explain the different wave in within Islam, and also there is a lot of reports with you know, all these French young people going to Syria and Iraq and really trying to see where they're from, and of course explaining, you know, I mean, that I can, I think, talk a bit about it because I've went to a high school in the suburb, in the banlieue, like we say, and I really saw the shift myself after 2001 and then when US invaded Iraq, and I saw a shift within people. I saw a lot of people converting. They were like young French Catholic women who converted, or Muslim who became much more radical, because in all these banlieue suburbs in France, people are really living within each other, and a lot of young people feel really excluded from the society. And I think we talked about it with David yesterday, and how when you don't have a purpose, you don't feel useful to the society, and you're being rejected from school, you cannot have an apartment in Paris because you're black or Arabs, then you seek refuge in your identity. And for a lot of young people in France, it was their religion. And most of the time, the parents were not even that religious, but people from my generation, a lot of people became much more religious. And so I was surprised, actually, to see how a lot of French people were really surprised with this wave of radicalism, because it's been growing in France since like more than 10 years, and I, you know, really saw it evolving. But once again, it was a bit hidden. And, you know, if you're from Paris and you're not confronted to that, not to that population, I mean, it was a big surprise for a lot of people that there is this all of a sudden, this thousand of young people, and some of them don't have any background religiously, I mean, don't have their family with Muslim, or became, you know, religious in 1 year, you know, and a lot of these people used to go to clubs and drinks. And so I think the French media really tried to explain, you know, all of these backgrounds and go back on the issues within the society, economical issues, who led these a lot of young people to feel excluded from French society, and how they seek identity into, for instance, religion. So I think I'm more aware of what's going on in France comparing to other European media, and I think there is, and maybe one last thing, I saw 2 days ago that France 2, so our second channel, national channel, went to interview in Syria a young woman, French woman, who was French Catholic and converted, and went to Syria with her children and got two other children in Syria with two other jihadists. She had like three husbands within Islamic State. And so the French journalists interview her and try to, you know, get a grasp of, like, did you really realize what you were doing? And it sparked like a huge debate on social media, like, should we, you know, because of course she's now held in Syria, and the debate is like, should she be welcomed back to France and probably jail, or should we let, you know, the Syrian and Kurds judge her? And she's trying to have at least her children brought back to France, and France is so divided on the subject, and it's sparked a lot of debate. But, you know, there was an effort to try to via these reports, trying to talk to French people who are still in Syria and join the Islamic State, to try to spark the debate and see how, and that's a big issue now in France for the return of this young jihadist and wife of jihadist.
Well, thank you very much for that. And of course, another transnational challenge is climate change. And a question from an attendee here in terms of, you know, the Bonn, Germany 2017 UN Climate Change Conference begins Monday. The question is, what is your country's position? And I want to know if you could comment on that quickly, but then broaden it a bit, please, in terms of how European nations, leaders, citizens are responding to President Trump's rejection of the Paris Climate Treaty.
This is actually part of our new of the debates of the parties who are trying to form a coalition now, that the Green Party, which is the ecologist party, is very pro the climate change and wants to establish strong goals and strong arguments, for example, to cut down the energy supply by coal. in Germany very quickly. And this is, of course, this is not only a story about climate change, but also a story about jobs. Actually, those people who are working in the traditional industry of coal, brown coal, black coal, that's those voters that the big parties try to get back. So there is a big sensitivity for securing jobs for those people. And this is done in a very traditional way, as not securing jobs for the people, but securing like the industries where the people work in. So I think this will be one part of conflict in this coalition debates, and probably there will be some kind of compromise, which is not in the sense of the Green Party. Mm-hmm. Generally, Germany is following those commitments for climate change. We have just recently, we had two very heavy storms in Germany, which is like in fall, it's usual to have storms, but that kind of strong storms with strong winds is not so usual. And there is a forecast that this winter will turn out 3 degrees Celsius warmer than usual, and it will be also there will be also many really heavy weather conditions. Mm-hmm. And I really think that climate change is really you can see it in front of your doorstep, and you cannot deny that it's happening. And I think all the politicians are aware of it, but as it is always the job of ruling parties, mm-hmm. to make compromises and reflect upon a lot of subjects that are interconnected, and in this sense, this is the question of climate, or of change of energies, and the situation of the labor market. And I think they Chancellor Merkel. I mean, she is still the chancellor, mm-hmm. even if though she is weak in the moment, and she is waiting for the next administration to come. She will take a strong voice in the world to follow those goals of climate change, mm-hmm. because like on the international level, I think she is still strong, mm-hmm. While she gets weaker and weaker on the national level politically.
Thank you very much. And David, you know, of course, the climate change agreement is a global accord, but it has to be agreed upon on a national basis. And so two questions I'm going to combine here, if you'll address both of them, in terms of nationalism. And, you know, what do you think the role of nationalism is in terms of sovereignty and legitimacy is? And a more specific one, and you certainly addressed some of these dynamics as you spoke this morning, but question, how united is the UK after Brexit? And why did Scotland and Northern Ireland vote to stay with the EU? And if you can just explore what you think is there, and then, you know.
So small subjects, yeah. So there is an argument, which you can see building in lots of places in the rich West, that people are, that thing I said in my talk about people feeling that they're exposed to kind of competition that's unfair and unbearable, kind of part of that is this argument that the world is more mobile than people want it to be, that no one chose for the world to be this mobile, to face this much competition, to have these open borders, to have these refugees turning up. And that's clearly true. I mean, people didn't choose for this to happen, and the populist game is to pretend that the elites also chose for it to happen deliberately because they don't care about you, the voter. So the remedy that is being proposed by some people who are not racists and are not kind of blood and soul nationalists is kind of liberal nationalism. So you see this kind of intellectual movement somewhat here, but certainly in Britain there are people writing about this guy called David Goodhart, who thinks that immigration needs to be restricted greatly just because the working classes have had the thin end of the sort of the wedge, and they won't tolerate it anymore. He has this argument about elites versus the common man, and it's about the people from somewhere who live in their hometown, who are loyal to that hometown, versus the people from nowhere. And I think he would call all of us on stage the people from nowhere. You know, we're kind of rootless, we've lived in different countries, we speak different languages, we're very at ease with each other, even though we're from different nationalities. And we're at ease with each other because we recognize We do the same kind of jobs, we have the same kind of educations, we take the same kind of holidays, you know, it's all of that kind of cultural identity. And that is very, very unpopular with the people from somewhere. The danger of liberal nationalism, I think, is that ultimately it's a form of, well, economically it's a form of protectionism. It's protectionism for people. It's saying that the people who were born here should have first claim on any job that's kind of going. So economically, if you go back to that idea of the stranger in town who turns up with a good idea, let him flourish, you know, it runs against that. But I also just, I don't see that many really convincing examples of wholly benign nationalism. I just think that at the core of it is the belief that some people are more French than others, some people are more British than others, that if you weren't here before a certain date, you don't get to claim to be from here. And I'm just very uncomfortable with the idea that that will make us happier. And that will make us all kind of relax. I mean, did you see Trump's speech to the United Nations General Assembly? He had this whole pitch about how if everyone was kind of like America and was looking out for their own interests, that would be the rational thing to do. I mean, the United Nations should be a kind of cockpit of sovereign nation states that wanted to be strong, sovereign, independent nations. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure Trump hasn't studied the Treaty of Westphalia, but that's kind of that kind of vision of kind of a cockpit of great powers kind of jostling. But, you know, we tried that. We know where that leads. It's not, you know, it's not a successful model. And so I'm very unconvinced by that. In the British context, one of the very destabilizing things that we learned during the Brexit vote was in part about English nationalism. Mm-hmm. That for a very long time, English people used England and Britain and English and British kind of interchangeably. And they didn't really make enough of a distinction between the two because, you know, in part it's a very imbalanced country. You know, 50-something million of the 60-something million are English. So Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland are really small. I mean, Wales is, I think, 2 million. Northern Ireland is like 1.5 million. Scotland is 8 million. I may have that slightly wrong, but, you know, it's 50-something million. England is the powerhouse demographically. So part of it was an English nationalist thing. Part of it was an anti-London vote. A lot of people just didn't like the sort of multicultural London kind of people of nowhere kind of elite kind of thing. Why did the Scots vote to stay? I mean, the Scots are not... The European Union does this very detailed polling every year. There's this thing, Eurobarometer. And I used to look at these numbers. The Scots are not much more pro-European than the English. You know, they also resent stuff like fisheries laws that mm-hmm. make everyone, you know, allowed to fish Scottish fish. It's partly about a kind of anti-English thing. Whatever the English are doing, the Scots will sort of slightly head the other way. There was a long time, the Scottish National Party, which was absolutely making the pitch that it was a kind of neutral, liberal, non-racist form of nationalism, their pitch was to be Scotland in Europe. That Scotland would declare its independence and would then be welcomed into this kind of Europe that was a kind of a framework, a bit like the Catalans. Mm. You know, Catalan nationalists will say, I'm not a racist, you know, whoa, because I want it to be Catalonia in Europe, an umbrella of Europe and then the regions of Europe kind of happily underneath. At the moment, nation states are proving really stubborn in terms of the thing that people feel an attachment to. I'll give you a final example of why Europe is... So when I was working in Brussels, there were all these kind of very, very nice, sort of well-meaning European officials who were trying to construct a European identity that would sort of work. And I remember every time there was an Olympic Games or the Oscars would come out, they would say, why are we looking at the medals table of the Olympic Games and saying it's China, America, and then, you know, Britain and whatever? Europe won the Olympics. If you add all our medals together, Europe won the Olympics. They'd have press conferences. And the problem was there was precisely nobody outside that press conference room in Brussels who believed it. You know, if you have a French and German runner, they're not going, you know, go Europe, you know. It just doesn't work. It's, you know, you can't invent this stuff. You can't create it in a kind of, in a PowerPoint.
Well, thank you. And that brings us to a question here. And please keep these coming because they've been terrific here. In terms of how some of these smaller countries, we've appropriately, because of the center of political gravity and your individual expertise, been talking about France and Germany and England and a few other nations, but The question is how smaller EU countries, the Baltics, the Nordics, as an example, are navigating the chaos of the US and the big countries of the EU. And I'll turn to you first in terms of how you see some of those nations, and perhaps with a particular word on a group of nations that don't get perhaps the attention they now deserve, nations such as Hungary and Poland, and those who some are accusing of drifting towards illiberalism here in the West.
Well, first of all, if you talk about the smaller states, the Baltic states come to my mind, which are really frightened by the Russian military practices that are close to their borders, and who really have those backlashes that their borders might not be so stable as we perceive them to be. And this Western integration might not be as secure, and also the Western solidarity in military terms might be not so so safe and so secure. So for them, it's a really difficult situation with the Russian engagements in Europe. Let's turn to Poland and to Hungary. I think those countries are trying, if we talk about like those countries within the European Union and what voice they have in the European Union, they really try to build a coalition among each other. And we had this, for example, in the discussions about relocation of asylum seekers, about contingents that would be sent to the specific EU countries that those so-called Visegrad states, this Visegrad group, resisted this and didn't this like country by country, but really tried to form a coalition to express their opinion and be stronger in with their opinion process against the Western European states. And I mean, of course, they all have their this kind of nationalism that is now like increasing in those countries, that is to be observed everywhere. And as a matter of fact, it's the same in East Germany, even though we don't have our own state administration. But it's the feelings, the emotions are the same. And this is maybe also an effect of the imbalances within Europe of poorer regions and more wealthy regions, and of people who feel they cannot catch up with the pace of globalization and the pace of those Western opinion-making traditions. And this is, I think, the same for all of those Eastern European countries.
David mentioned, of course, the situation in Spain and the dispute between Barcelona and Madrid. And I want to know if you could give your perspective on where you see this situation headed. And do you think it's symptomatic of other future efforts for, you know, perhaps in, you know, some of these smaller European nations to have breakaway portions of them who want to declare their own independence?
So I've been following the Barcelona-Catalonia from afar and being very busy with Donald Trump's here. But I think, I mean, it's been going on for years.
Right.
So it's, from a French point of view, it's not that surprising. But it's surprising that so quickly we arrive at this conclusion and that they, you know, they voted for independence. They declare independence. I think that definitely the nationalism wave in Europe and after what happened in the US really had an impact. I mean, I feel people feel much more emboldened. We saw it in Czech Republic, Austria. So I think it's kind of part, even though it's not the same motivation, it's kind of part of the same wave. I mean, I think most of your European leaders have been very clear and say that their interlocutor, the main contact is, you know, Madrid, and they will, you know, they've been very clear on that they were supporting the Spanish government. But of course it doesn't, you know, I think it can really, this populism, nationalism wave can continue. And I think a lot of observers in France have been also saying that, you know, even though Macron has been elected and it reassures kind of Europe and the world, It's really not the end of populism and nationalism in Europe. It's only the beginning because, you know, you have so many people who feel dépassé, so they feel like they
left behind.
Yeah, this global world, this multicultural world. That I do think too that it's kind of the beginning, and there will need to be like, I mean, a huge economic boost in most of these countries to really, and that's what Macron maybe is going to do or tries to do in France before this wave, you know, decreased.
Thank you very much. And certainly the populism and the nationalism played a prominent role in the U.S. election. And I'll turn to you, David, because we have a question here in terms of the degree that the U.S. tried to help the countries, you know, with refugees and some of the challenges that are happening in their home countries. What's the European perception of President Trump's actions regarding refugees? To what degree has this become a transatlantic political challenge for the alliance, and how is that playing out?
So look, if you had to grow an American president in a test tube to offend European public opinion, you'd basically have a reality TV star with bad hair and kind of bling and who says racist stuff and closes his borders and appears to be very ignorant. And I mean, just it plays into every single stereotype there is. I think if Europeans attacked Donald Trump for being unwilling to let in refugees, there would be an element of hypocrisy. I try and explain to European readers as well as American readers, I mean, half our circulation is in the States, but we also have European readers too. It feels different. I mean, in Europe, if you're a European government, refugees can walk to your country. So you have to kind of deal with it some way. But they can walk to your country from Syria. You can't walk to America from Syria. So any American president starts from a very different place. Letting refugees into this country, which we as The Economist support, is a choice, and it's a very visible political choice. So the stakes are different for any American president. One thing I would warn both sides, I've heard this in the West Wing, is there's a real kind of sleeper issue here, which is one of the things that the nationalists in the West Wing are very unhappy about with Angela Merkel admitting a million refugees from places like Syria, is that soon lots of them will get European residence cards or passports, which gets them visa-free entry to the US. And the first time, and let's hope it never happens, but the first time there is a terrorist attack in this country carried out by someone who came in without a visa because they're European, you know, there's just going to be the most almighty crisis. There are people in the West Wing who would cancel the visa waiver program. Now, business would go berserk. It's tens of millions of arrivals a year. So it would be insane to start cutting it. But all bets would be off, I think.
You know, we have a question here about the weakness of Southern Europe and some of the financial dynamics that you're talking about. But I want to maybe broaden it a bit here. A country that, of course, is extraordinarily important to the EU project is Italy. And I want to know, Professor, if I could turn to you, please. And of course, everyone here has been following, you know, the challenges that they have been facing with migration from sub-Saharan Africa and other portions of North Africa here. Where do you see that situation going? And, you know, to use the word, you know, an unstable Italian government is perhaps redundant, considering how often, you know, they change leaders. But just what kind of a more systemic governing political challenge does this present?
Well, we really don't have to forget that you can also walk through the whole of Europe. So the people who arrive in Italy over those central Mediterranean route and that started to increase in 2011 with the Arab Spring. That many people like headed for this central Mediterranean route and arrived in those southern Italian places and islands, which are not really fit to receive so many migrants. And since the Balkan route is closed quite effectively, those numbers are increasing heavily again. So since years, the European Union left Italy completely alone with this situation, as also Greece is quite left alone. I mean, there's money sent there. There are some international activists also in Greece. But both countries are until today left alone with arriving migrants, be it asylum seekers, be it irregular migrants, whatever you call them, people you have to deal with. You cannot sent back or just deny their boats to get to your coastline. And this is a complete lack of European solidarity towards those countries. And this will lead to even more destabilization. I mean, we had other public votes in the north of Italy, where some of the more wealthy regions tried to express their will, like Catalonia, to become more independent, mm-hmm. and to get out of this Italian Union. And we recently had also a small terrorist incident of a person who sent a bomb from Greece to Germany, to mm-hmm. the financial ministry. Mm-hmm. Who objects of course the austerity policies of the European Union mm-hmm. against Greece, mm-hmm. Which is mainly also again the mm-hmm. role of Chancellor Merkel, who decided for this, or who took a strong vote on this. Within Europe we need more solidarity with our fellow citizens, but of course also with mm-hmm. those who are coming to Europe and mm-hmm. who cannot be locked into one specific country.
Well, thank you very much. And we have just a few minutes left here. So I thought we would end with each panelist giving this a thought. I'll start with you, David, here in a moment. When we talk about Europe, you're talking about dozens of countries. When you're talking about the challenges and changes, you can think of that number exponentially. But so, as much breadth and depth as you as panelists have covered, there are regions, issues, ideas happening in Europe that are perhaps underplayed. So in terms of something that, if we're reconvening this panel in a year or two, something that is a significant challenge that you think we'll be talking about more, and then something that is hopeful, something that is positive, a development that you see happening that, gives Europe perhaps a brighter future, what do you think we might be talking about then?
So I think we'll be talking about Europe picking big fights with American tech giants. I think Europe, lots of European countries, particularly Germany, they're slightly neuralgic about privacy, I would say. I don't fully understand the German neuralgia about privacy, but it's a historical thing. But you will see, I think, really gigantic fights around Europe trying to regulate Facebook and Google, and that's going to be a big thing we'll be talking about next year, and that will bleed across into all kinds of other trade issues. A positive thing. I mean, we spend a lot of time bashing Europe for its handling of the refugee crisis, but I mean, it's a lot of refugees that have been taken in, and there's a lot of really good people in Europe kind of trying to teach them German and trying to teach them Swedish and trying to get them homes and things. I mean, Europe is doing pretty well given how many people walked in, in the last 2 or 3 years. And Angela Merkel's a brave politician who did the right thing. And Emmanuel Macron has signs of kind of courage, too. There was a moment during the election, which was kind of amazing, where one of the kind of worst things for any French president is to find themselves at the gates of a factory where the factory might close. And, Nicolas Sarkozy, he went to this plant called Gondrange and said, promised that he would keep it open. And, the will of the politicians and volonté de l'État was not going to let this thing move. And then, of course, it moved because he can't make China go away or, wherever it was going. Macron, during the election campaign, went to the gates of a factory. And I think Le Pen almost ambushed him. They tried to put it, they were at the same factory. And basically, Macron stood there with the TV cameras rolling and said, I can't keep your factory open. That's not in my power. And I'm not going to promise you something I can't do. You need to be told the truth. You need to. And they were like shouting. And it was the whole thing. That was pretty gutsy. That was gutsy. So Europe deserves some credit. I worry that Europe is kind of old and tired at the moment. That's how it sort of slightly feels to me. My kids have British passports and American passports, and the British passports are getting less useful by the day. But I'm kind of glad they had that hedge. Mm-hmm. You know, so America's got some big problems right now, but it's a young, mm-hmm. kind of dynamic country. Europe's a wonderful place, but it feels a bit old and tired right now.
Thank you very much. Professor, please.
So it's time for the optimistic message.
as well as something we should keep our eyes on that you think we might be talking about, challenge.
I mean, of course, it's all about economics all the time. Right. And also, like, the European idea was originally one of economic cooperation. And of course, you can never forget, like, the individuals behind it. And where we are nowadays, it's really like in Europe, which is so mixed. There are so many people who have those mobility experiences, and you have mixed marriages, and you have people who live in other places and so on. You cannot really roll back in time. So even though, like, we disintegrate even more, this is somehow on the personal level, this is just not possible. And now comes my positive message. We have since last year, there are some grassroots initiatives that are organizing public demonstrations, March for Europe, which are also shared over social media, because nothing that is not in the social media really happens. So the reality is created by the social media. Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, it's still a small movement, but I think there is more and more sensitivity that we have something which is very worthy with the European Union, and we cannot just throw it away because we have some serious problems to face. I think we have to enforce those movements from the grassroots and from the individuals who see more of those European achievements for themselves as individuals.
Well, thank you for that. And finally, Sonia, please, same question.
I'm going to base my optimism and negativism, I think, also on my last few years in Egypt. I arrived here 2 years and a half ago, and before I was in Egypt. And so I work in Egypt in a very, very divided country, like the population was hugely divided. And I think for me, it's a bit scary and sad to see now how France and the US are also more and more divided within the population. And also the skepticism within media, I mean, towards the media, we were very targeted in Egypt, and now arriving in America and see, you know, even when you want to ask questions to the population, you have a lot of skepticism and you know, insults. So I think that's pretty negative, and I see that in France too. On the optimism side, I think also having spent years following activists in Egypt that were in a very, very dark situation, but had so much hope, and always, you know, there was so much solidarity between the young people, and they really managed to create great things, and there were more creativity in art and everything. I see that also a lot since I arrived in the US, so 2 years and a half ago. I feel that people are, I mean, I just feel like the society has been a bit more awakened. In France, we were used to protest, but arriving here and after the Trump election, participating in the Women's March, nowadays I'm following Dreamers, I'm covering stories with them, and there is so much positive energy, and I see that, I think that for the young generation, I mean, that's a great way also to be more engaged in the society and to feel, you know, there is big stake. I think growing up in France, we were also a bit like spoiled child, and, you know, we didn't so much of the stake that nowadays the world is facing, so I think it's a great opportunity for young people to be more engaged.
Well, terrific, and thank you for ending on that note. Thank you very much for being here, for your participation, and the great questions. Sorry I couldn't get to all of them. And if you'll please join me in a round of applause for our three terrific panelists. Thank you.